This meeting of the Senate Health, Housing, and Family Security Committee will come to order. Senator Sharon, you've got the first bill on the agenda. Welcome to the committee.
Thank you very much, Chair Marty. The first bill is Senate File 128 relating to Minnesota Care. This bill has been in front of this committee before. And what this bill actually does is authorize the department to attempt to get the waivers that are appropriate for us to be able to follow through with the plan that's already been supported by the legislature. Actually, this initiative was started by Senator Paul Coring in 2003. It was brought forward to you again by Senator Lori last year, and we passed it. But unfortunately, the federal government struck down our efforts to provide health coverage to hundreds of self-employed farmers in Minnesota. The legislation we passed in 2007 was aimed at addressing a critical problem in rural Minnesota, where farmers cannot afford to purchase health insurance on the open market. And too many farmers are shut out of Minnesota care because they're considered to be too wealthy. But the problem is that these farmers are not really wealthy because what they do is have a number of assets, and those assets specifically are expensive equipment that they rely on to run their operations and their business. However, in the current Minnesota care eligibility rules, the retail value of that equipment counts, and it in fact creates a false sense of wealth for the farmer and does not allow them to become eligible for entry into the Minnesota Care program. The plan that was introduced in 2003 by Senator Coring and again by Senator Lori, and now this year I'm happy to be leading the charge again, is to use the real depreciated value of the farm equipment, the actual value of their tractor and combines after years of farm use, when applying for a Minnesota Care program. It's a common sense approach to fixing a difficult issue of bringing health care to farm families. Because the Minnesota Care program is run in partnership with the federal government, any change to the eligibility requirements must be approved by the Federal Centers for Medicaid and Medical Assistance. This process of approval was denied, and it meant about 500 farmers and their families would not be eligible for health insurance that they've come to depend upon. So you might ask, because it's been denied, why are we here in front of you again? The answer is because there's been a change in the administration. And although we continue as a legislature to support this since 2003 when Senator Coring, as I've already indicated, initiated this process, we have had a change at the federal level, and we believe, we hope, that if you will authorize the department to again request this waiver, that we might be successful this time and bring this Minnesota Care program to Minnesota farm families. With that, I would introduce Tom Peterson from the Farmers Union, and he is here to answer any specific questions you may have.
Welcome to the committee. Did you want to make a brief statement as well, Mr. Peterson?
Mr. Chairman, sure. My name is Tom Peterson. I represent the Minnesota Farmers Union, and very briefly, we also support this legislation that we worked on for on behalf of our members and Senator Coring, Senator Lori, since 2003. We're concerned about health care, and this has always been an issue for us with dairy farmers that are kind of starting out or transitioning from their parents' farm, but we also see it now with the growth in local, organic, sustainable farms where they're starting farming. They don't have a lot of assets, but they're buying things, and then they run into this problem with the depreciation. And this always is, I'll hear about this in April or May is when I get calls about this. People do their taxes. They find out however it works with the county rules, and then the people are notified that they're no longer eligible for Minnesota Care. And it kind of comes as a surprise to them, too. And I think it's always really unfortunate. And the farmers, they do a good job. They always say, I record every carrot, every bale of hay I sold, and I lost my eligibility with the depreciation factored in over a very small amount of money that I honestly reported. And so I just for the committee, too, real quick, that the things that are in depreciation are livestock for breeding, perennial crop development, such as you're starting a vineyard or an orchard, and then machinery, equipment, and then buildings and improvements to those real estate buildings. So in conclusion, I urge your consideration support for this bill.
Thank you, Mr. Pearson. Senator Lurie.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I guess I would just like to add, too, I know Senator Coring knows as well, you know, when we talk about depreciation, it needs to be made very clear. This is an actual cost of doing business on a farm. I mean, you got to imagine the farm. We haul this equipment out into the fields. It's a rough terrain. I mean, we beat the heck out of it, and it depreciates. It depreciates fast, and you got to replace it. You got to keep it up. Depreciation is an actual cost of doing business. And at the bottom line, once you've figured out your taxes, to take that cost of doing business and add it back in as if it's profit, it just doesn't work for us. And so that's why we've been working so hard for so long to rectify this situation.
Senator Lynch.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Senator Sheeran, I wanted to thank you for bringing this legislation forward. And most often around here, I'm associated with the community of Rochester. But I very much represent the communities of Plainview, Dover, Yoda, Chatfield, Stuartville. So I hear about this concern from my constituents on a very real and a very regular basis. And I think it is very appropriate that we approach CMS on this once again.
Further discussion from the committee? If not,
are we going to move this out of here? Or what?
Yes, this bill goes to
this goes
finance.
To the finance.
Okay. If was there any amendments, Mr. Chairman? Okay. If there was no amendments, sorry about that. If there is no amendments, I would, Mr. Chairman, if it would be okay, I would move that Senate File 128 be recommended to pass and sent to the Finance Committee.
On that motion, is there anyone who would speak in opposition to the bill? If not, if no discussion, all those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Motion prevails. Thank you. Sharon, one more bill.
Yes. Let's see. What's our number here? Senate File 366.
I believe you have a delete everything amendment.
We have a delete. The A1 amendment is a delete.
Senator Torres-Ray moves the A1 amendment to put the bill in the shape the author wishes. Is there any discussion? If not, all those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Motion prevails.
Thank you, Chair Marty. This bill is a proposal to develop a pilot project that will implement colorectal screening program for uninsured and underinsured Minnesotans. Colorectal cancer is the second leading cause of cancer-related deaths in the United States and is estimated to have taken over 50,000 lives in 2007. However, because of efforts to increase awareness in screening, as well as improved treatments, the number of deaths from colorectal cancer has been dropping in the last 15 years. While the benefits of early screening are well known, this is one screening where we know that we're able to detect cancer early, prevent its progression, and save healthcare dollars. The American Cancer Society notes that nearly 40% of Minnesotans over the age of 50 have not been screened. Now, this is one way that we know that this is probably a bill that won't get overutilized. You know, even people who have insurance aren't racing off to have this screening. The numbers are even more troubling if uninsured Minnesotans, 80% of which have never been screened for colorectal cancer, 80% never screened for colorectal cancer, a preventable form of cancer. Uninsured patients are 64% more likely to die from this disease than from those who are adequately insured. Senate File 366 would increase the early detection of the disease by establishing a state-sponsored screening program for Minnesotans over the age of 50 or those younger than 50 but considered at high risk for colon cancer. The program would be available to individuals who do not have an insurance plan that covers routine colorectal screening and whose income is below 250% of the federal poverty level. For those that are eligible, the program would provide screenings, follow-up services for abnormal tests, and diagnostic services. Under the bill, if an individual without medical insurance is found to have colorectal screening, their treatment would be covered by medical assistance. Medical assistance coverage would end when the treatment for cancer is completed. The importance of early screening for colorectal cancer cannot be understated. When the disease is allowed to grow and spread, it becomes unmanageable and all too frequently fatal. Research shows that 9 out of 10 people survive the disease when it is caught and treated early. So that's the essence of the bill. I am willing to walk through the bill more specifically if you would like me to. I think it's fairly easy to follow. So unless you want me to do that, I would defer to the testimony of the people that have joined me here at the table, Chair.
Why don't we go ahead with the testimony?
Let's see, I think is it... Who wants to go first here? Is it Dave Ahrens? Do you want
sure,
to do that?
Start
with David Ahrens from the American Cancer Society.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, my name is David Ahrens, Director of Government Relations for the American Cancer Society in Minnesota. We thank you very much for the opportunity to testify. The Society is the largest volunteer organization in Minnesota solely devoted to the elimination of cancer and throughout the nation. Cancer is Minnesota's leading cause of death, and according to the latest statistics, 1 out of every 2 Minnesotans will be diagnosed with a potentially serious cancer in their lifetime. Fighting cancer is a mission we all share in our state, and I know it's a mission of this committee. I urge your support today for Minnesota's Colorectal Cancer Prevention Act, Senate File 366. This bill is aimed at solving a problem, and it's aimed at solving costs, particularly in a bad budget situation. Colorectal cancer is one of the most preventable cancers there is if people get screening. If a person is screened early, the survival rate is close to 90%. One type of screening, a colonoscopy, can literally remove a potentially cancerous polyp from a colon, thereby ruling out the potential for cancer. Now, colorectal cancer is, as you know, probably very expensive, very, very expensive way to treat. By some estimates, the cost to treat colon cancer range from $16,000 at the early stage to $200,000. Now, when you're trying to treat those who have no health insurance, the costs of treatment fall to hospitals like HCMC and MeritCare, and then rural hospitals and urban hospitals. They also fall to state public health insurance programs. But if we do screening, our hope is that we prevent cancer, thereby ruling out the potential treatment costs. This project would set up a demonstration project making 2 grants, one to HCMC and one to MeritCare. The idea with HCMC and MeritCare is they both serve populations with high number of uninsured people. Both institutions have the requisite capacity to do the screening right away. And the whole idea behind this demonstration project as well is not only to do colon cancer screening to save lives immediately, to prevent treatment costs, but it's also to position the state to potentially receive federal matching funds, because Congress right now is considering in its FY 2009 appropriations package colorectal screening funding through the CDC, which would match up to state-level programs. But what we know from talking to the federal government is that if states that get programs, even tiny ones, up and running, probably have a better chance of getting this federal funding than states that have no program at all. And so our hope is that Minnesota will not be one of the states that doesn't have a program, but that we can get something up and running, even in a small way, in 2 sites, to get something started. We think the treatment costs in this demonstration project will be very low, because out of about 200 people screened in this project, the likelihood of anyone getting cancer is about 1%, because you're only screening asymptomatic people, people without showing any symptoms. So if someone has cancer, the burden on medical assistance is going to be very, very low, at the low end of the treatment range, and likelihood is very low that they'll get cancer to begin with. This bill also doesn't increase the size of government. We're not creating a big program here. This is a grant demonstration project. And so it doesn't build the size of the health department really in any way. The main thing here is that Minnesota has been trying to continue with health care reform. This is a great way to keep going with health care reform through prevention to save costs, save lives in a very tough economic climate. And we really understand that, appreciate that, and are trying to bring forward an idea for the state to do what it wants to do, and that's save lives and save costs and take on colon cancer, which really shouldn't be as big of a burden as it is to the state, because colon cancer is one of the most preventable types of cancer. Trying to take colon cancer off the charts as Minnesota's second leading killer of cancer death. I urge your support for this bill and very much appreciate your time to hear what we have to say today.
Thank you. And Mr. Ahrens, with the federal match, which right now is 3-1?
That's the idea, is there's money that's in the federal fiscal year 09 Labor, Health, and Human Services Appropriations Bill, which is moving quickly in Congress. The House, Senate are supposed to pass those bills within the next 2 weeks, and that money includes around $38, $39 million that would go to the CDC's chronic disease section to then fund state-level colorectal cancer screening programs for programs that screen the uninsured and underinsured. So we're trying to align the stars here, if you will, with this potential federal funding. Of course, there's no guarantees with the federal government, but we're trying to do the best we can to position Minnesota to receive some money.
And accordingly, assuming it goes the way you'd expect, no matter what we put into this for the two hospitals, the two HCMC and Merit Care, we would not be taking advantage of all the 3-1 match? Or you think if we funded in what you're looking for here, would we get all the federal money we'd be able to, or that's hard to say?
Well, if the bigger the state investment gets, the more potential federal dollars one could potentially secure if it's $3 to $1. What we did with this project was pick two sites to try to screen a very small number of people to keep the fiscal note very low so that we could get going even in a tough climate to position ourselves. So it was the good part about colorectal cancer screening is that because you can remove polyps in one afternoon, it's proven prevention. There's no doubt about it. You're preventing the cancer if you remove the polyps.
Thank you. Ms. Erickson, you want to go next?
Chairman Marty and members of the committee, thank you for letting me share my story with you today. My name is Mary Erickson, and I'm here to share my experience with doctors and nurses in our community who are stepping up to help people like me who need important cancer screening services but can't afford them. I'm a 60-year-old mother of two and grandmother of seven. I grew up in Minnesota and currently live in Little Canada. I've worked all my life and at most times have had health care coverage. I'm currently laid off, and for the previous 6 years, even though I've been working full-time, my employer did not offer health insurance. I've been without insurance for 7 years, and I live every day hoping nothing terrible happens. I get my day-to-day health care from a local clinic that offers a sliding scale payment. I looked into Minnesota Care, but my savings for retirement make me ineligible. I currently live off unemployment compensation and my savings. My mother died of breast cancer, so I've always made breast cancer screening a priority. I get mammograms and checkups through the SAGE Breast Cancer Screening Program, and I've used SAGE for mammograms and pap smears for more than 10 years. I'm so grateful for this service. It gives me peace of mind, and I know if anything is detected, I'll catch it early when it can be treated and cured. For 10 years, I've also known that I should get screened for colon cancer. Everybody should when they turn 50, and it had been on my to-do list. Nagging in my mind was the fact that my father has had polyps removed over the years and needs regular colonoscopies for follow-up. I knew that I was long overdue for a test, but with no insurance, it was just too expensive. What really motivated me was the experience of a dear friend who came down with colon cancer at age 56. I've seen how devastating and expensive the disease can be. She had to have part of her colon removed and underwent chemotherapy treatment. She didn't get screened at 50. Maybe if she had, they would have caught the cancer earlier. While searching for an affordable way to get screened, I learned from the American Cancer Society about a free colon cancer screening day at Regents Hospital. I was fortunate. I qualified and received a free colonoscopy in May of last year. During the procedure, they did find and remove 3 polyps, which means they may have prevented cancer down the road. I won't need another for 5 years, and I have peace of mind knowing I don't have undetected colon cancer. I'm so grateful to the physicians and the nurses and other volunteers who made it possible for me to get screened. Unfortunately, I know there are a lot of people out there in my situation who may not be as lucky as me. I just wish that colon cancer screening was available to everyone who needs it. I hope you will support Senator Sharon's bill so that people like me will be able to get screened and know whether or not they have colon cancer before it's too late. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Erickson. Mr. Albrecht, Dr. Albrecht.
Yes, thank you, Senator Marty, and members of the committee for the opportunity today to speak in favor of Senator Sharon's bill. I'm a gastroenterologist at Hennepin County Medical Center, which is the major safety net hospital in the state of Minnesota. I'm also a professor of medicine at the University of Minnesota. During my career, I've probably performed more than 10,000 colonoscopies and have diagnosed and or treated hundreds of patients with various stages of colorectal cancer. I can tell you that colon cancer is a very frustrating disease to discover and to treat at an advanced stage for the reasons that were articulated earlier. This is a preventable disease because there is a long period of time when patients with who will develop cancer have a pre-malignant lesion called a colon polyp. Colonoscopy involves visualizing the entire colon with an endoscope and removing polyps and other abnormalities with the scope, and it's a very cost-effective and safe screening test. And Dr. Church can speak much more effectively about that. I can tell you parenthetically that over the last year, and particularly over the last 6 months, I've seen a greater number of uninsured patients, both working and unemployed patients, than I've ever seen in my career, and this is an increasing problem. Right now, as mentioned earlier, many Minnesotans who are eligible, that medically eligible for colorectal cancer screening are not getting the test. Some of that is due to personal choice, but a lot of it is due to the fact that patients are scared off by the costs. And that removing that barrier for some of our uninsured patients will allow more patients to get screened will reduce the incidence of colon cancer substantially in that population. The cost of not diagnosing a cancer is obvious to everyone. As mentioned earlier, there's about 150,000 cases of colon cancer diagnosed every year in the U.S., and about 50,000 patients will die. And so that's the gravest cost. In addition, a recent review of 18 advanced colon cancer patients at HCMC indicated that the cost of caring for these folks with advanced colon cancer exceeds $200,000. So under the program outlined here, we could screen almost 200 patients for the cost of treating one colon cancer case. HCMC has a large network of community clinics, many of whom take care of the underserved, and obviously we will have no trouble finding eligible patients. We also take referrals from all over the state, so we have both the capacity and the referral network to handle this number of patients and more. So thank you very much for your attention to this bill, and I'd be happy to take any questions.
Thank you, Dr. Albrecht. Dr. Church.
Thank you, Chairman Marty, and thank you, members of the Senate Committee on Health, Housing and Family Security, for this opportunity to talk about this bill today. My name is Tim Church, as you mentioned, and I'm a full professor in the Environmental Health Sciences Division of the University of Minnesota School of Public Health. I've spent most of my career since the mid-70s studying colorectal cancer screening. My colleagues and I conducted the very first study that demonstrated that such screening can reduce the deaths that we see from colorectal cancer. It also was the first study to demonstrate that screening could prevent colorectal cancer from happening in the first place by removing colon polyps. This is significant because it means that not only can we save lives, but we can also avoid the pain and anxiety of colorectal cancer diagnosis and treatment. This also means saving the enormous costs that have been mentioned of colorectal cancer therapy for insurers, hospitals, and ultimately us, the public. Over the years, my group has built a large research program to support studies evaluating colorectal cancer screening. I'm currently directing large trials in screening for colorectal cancer, lung cancer, ovarian cancer, and prostate cancer. My research has involved nearly 100,000 Minnesotans who volunteer to be part of these studies. Clearly, this indicates widespread support for cancer screening among ordinary Minnesotans. In summary, this bill would extend a proven method of cancer detection and prevention to those who currently do not have it. My research is uniquely positioned to help evaluate this process. Thank you.
Thank you. Questions from the committee? Senator Sharon.
I just wanted to speak very briefly again to what the essence of the bill is. It establishes these grants for a demonstration project for colorectal cancer screening for uninsured or underinsured. It provides medical assistance coverage for necessary treatment if it's determined. It ends at the end of the treatment process. It extends requires the Commissioner of Health to award grants to two locations, Hennepin County Medical Center and Maricare in Bemidji. These have been selected because they have ready available persons who would be able to participate in the program, and because they really focus on populations that are underserved and that are at very high risk for untreated colon cancer. It also requires anybody who participates in this program to be 50 years of age or older, or a high risk, meeting high risk criteria for colon cancer, uninsured or underinsured, or have coverage that doesn't cover the full costs of the screening. They have to be ineligible for medical assistance, general assistance, medical care, or Minnesota care programs, and their gross family income has to be below 250% of the federal poverty guidelines. The services under the demonstration project would include colorectal screening, follow-up services for abnormal tests, diagnostic services to determine the extent of the treatment, and then the last section, subdivision 5 of the bill, requires the Commissioner of Health in consultation with the University of Minnesota to evaluate the demonstration project and make recommendations to the legislature in 2011 for the increasing the number of individuals in Minnesota who should receive colon cancer screening.
Thank you, Senator Sharon. Is there discussion from the committee? I was thinking when you were describing the bill, put this in perspective a little bit, when you mentioned how medical assistance will be provided, but as soon as they're done with treatment, they're kicked off medical assistance, which I was going to say, everybody agrees that this makes sense, what your bill does, and I think we all realize we need to do it. But even if we do everything in here, we're asking for funding for two particularly important communities because of the need. Two out of umpteen hospitals and places in the state that could use it. And again, as I mentioned, we give them health care while they're getting treated, and then we kick them off it and so on. And even with this limited bill, I think we all realize we got a very uphill battle this year because of the budget situation. I think we should keep this in perspective, how trying to do little things that we all agree makes good sense, we're not even able to do that when we should frankly be doing it for everybody in the state, period. But, Senator Lynch.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Senator Sharon, thanks for bringing this good cause forward. You were very deliberate in identifying which segment of the population would be eligible for this. Does this follow a same pattern or similar guidelines to what we have, for example, in the SAGE program?
Senator Marty, yes, Senator Lynch, that the language was written to be in line with and to follow, especially for the coverage of, under medical assistance SAGE program.
Senator Lynch moves. Senator Lynch?
Mr. Chair and Senator Sharon. Senator Sharon, I wonder if on your A1 in lines 1.22 to 1.27, where it's defining the purpose, it begins with colon cancer is Minnesota's leading causes of death and one of the most preventable forms of cancer, and goes on from there. I'm more in the line of thinking that it's not necessary or to delineate that purpose in statute. I think it's important to note, and that's been done here today, but I'm not quite so comfortable sending that forward as statutory language. And again, that would be lines 1.22 through 1.27, and I'd be interested in your comment.
I think that Senator Marty, if I may, and Senator Lynch, would you look at that again, Senator Lynch? And if we eliminated colon cancer as one of the leading causes of preventable forms of cancer and left the remaining language that speaks to purpose, would that resolve the issue of what's written into statutory language? Is your issue, do we put the purpose for a bill in statute? I think that's your question, right? And I'm not certain how to address that.
Senator Lynch.
Mr. Chair and Senator Sharon, I don't know if we put the purpose in statute or not. I'm suggesting that it is not necessary, and I don't think it does anything to add to the bill or to the statutory language, nor do I think necessarily that it detracts. What we should be focusing on is what's pertinent to have in statute, and I'm suggesting that that those lines in its entirety is important to note in the discussion, but not to move forward in statute. So, Mr. Chair, I would move to amend the A1 with deleting lines 1.22 through 1.27.
Senator Lynch moves to delete lines subdivision 1 under section 2. And I agree with what you're saying, but this would not be codified language. This would only be in session laws. But on that motion, discussion, if not all, Senator Fischbach.
Mr. Chair, I would, I actually support Senator Lynch's motion. And I would just like to add, and I won't make the motion, but I'm not a big fan of naming things in legislation. And so in a perfect world, I would have included 1.212, but I just wanted to add that because I know that in the past I have mentioned naming things in legislation.
On Senator Lynch's motion, all those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Motion prevails. On the bill, Senator Erickson Ropes moves Senate file 366 as amended be recommended to pass and re-referred to the Committee on Finance. And even if we pass this, I think we should be angry that we're not doing more, but I appreciate your bringing the bill forward. On Senator Erickson Rope's motion, all those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Motion prevails.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Thank
Sir
you.
Torres Ray.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, and thank you, members. Senate file 522 intends to change only a number that has significant implications for a vast number of young people in the state of Minnesota and this country. Mr. Chairman and members, Senate file 522 intends to reduce the elevated blood lead level from 10 micrograms of lead PD of blood to 5 micrograms. And as members of this committee may know very well, we have made significant progress in this area. And we know a lot more today about the effects and toxicity of lead, and we have adopted significant legislation to address those issues. However, during the last 20 years, we have learned a lot more, and we now understand that blood lead concentrations that once we believed were safe are actually toxic for children, for children's developing brain and neurological system. So we know that even small amounts of lead in blood for young children really impair their learning and many other areas. There is growing scientific evidence that has been published since 1991 that demonstrate the adverse effects among of lead among children. And I have two experts today that would like to testify and speak about this issue. And members, I know that this is a difficult time, and you probably will have many questions about the cost of this change. And so I went ahead and asked and requested a fiscal note on this. And what I have been told is that the cost to this will be very, very marginal, because what we will be doing is really to encourage to do this test on children that are being tested for already, and we do significant testing for iron in children's blood. So that would be something that could be done additionally for young children. I also wanted to bring this to your attention, because we are learning now that this is an issue that impacts low-income children and children that live in urban communities. And these are disproportionately poor children, children of color, that live in older homes and attend schools that are in old buildings. And so that is the main reason I want to bring this to your attention, because we can make a big difference by adopting this language today. And I have Mr. Sam Yamin, who is a public health scientist from the Minnesota Center of Environmental Advocacy, who will be speaking about this issue, and Mr. Dan Newman, who is the executive director of the Sustainable Resource Center, who will present to you some of the evidence and will respond to some of the questions you may have.
Is it Yamin?
Yes.
Yes. Okay. State your name for the record, and then proceed with your testimony.
Samuel Yamin, public health scientist, Minnesota Center for Environmental Advocacy. And I did have some materials here for committee members. So
okay.
If one of the staff could please give those to the committee members. Thank you. As Senator Torres-Ray had mentioned, Senate File 522 is a very simple and focused piece of legislation, yet it is also very important. Also, as the senator mentioned, the intent of the legislation is to change the definition of children's elevated blood lead level from 10 micrograms of lead in a deciliter of blood, changing that to 5 micrograms per deciliter. I will describe why that's necessary and how it fits in with existing lead poisoning prevention efforts. The toxic effects of lead exposure on the human brain and nervous system have been recognized for centuries. During the second half of the 20th century, it became increasingly evident that lower exposures to lead can also cause lasting impacts on intelligence and behavior, even when the dose is not immediately life-threatening. The higher exposures have been identified as risk factor for children, young people dropping out of high school, as well as for juvenile delinquency and criminal arrest. We've seen those as the manifestations of the brain and intellectual impacts. And those are some of the costs to society of this. And young children are especially susceptible to lead hazards. Again, over the past 40 years, great progress has been made in reducing the average lead exposure levels among children, yet problem still exists. The most widespread source of lead exposure today is lead paint. Lead was banned from paint production in 1978, but lead paint is still present in and around many older homes. Young children are at highest risk because they tend to crawl and play in dust or soils that may have lead paint or other particles in it. And some children have been known to just put paint chips directly into their mouth and take in the lead that way. Additionally, young children's brain and nervous system are developing. So the neurotoxic effects of lead can last throughout the lifetime. Children's risk from lead is typically assessed by testing the concentration of lead in their blood, which in turn reflects their exposure to lead from the home environment or elsewhere. The Centers for Disease Control, the CDC, and other public health agencies publish guidelines for blood lead testing and recommend public health actions to be taken at each exposure threshold as measured by the blood test. And the lowest of these regulatory thresholds is the 10 micrograms of lead per deciliter of blood, which this legislation addresses. And this concentration is called by the CDC the level of concern, and the same concentration is enforced here in Minnesota as the elevated blood lead level. Beneath this level, no public health actions are currently required. However, the CDC has acknowledged that current science, 2009, the science demonstrates that this standard is not sufficiently protective. This slide shows how the CDC standard has changed over time. I also included this slide as a separate sheet in the handout materials for committee members. Over the past 40 years, science has repeatedly shown that blood lead concentrations that were once believed to be safe are actually toxic to children's developing brains and nervous system. Back in the 1960s, a concentration of 60 micrograms of lead per deciliter of blood or higher was considered elevated. Well, this is the level where you see overt toxicity. It's actually life-threatening, and you can visibly, even a non-expert, can visibly see changes in the individual's behavior and disposition. Since that time, as you can see, the CDC has reduced its acceptable exposure limit or level of concern 4 times due to scientific evidence of harm. At each of these milestones, when the weight of scientific evidence showed that children's health and development are impacted at levels below the benchmark where it was previously believed to be safe, the agency acted to adjust its lower threshold in accordance with the science. Last time CDC did this was 1991, and when they did so, the CDC explained that the level of 10 micrograms was the lower level of the range at which effects had been identified at that time. 18 years later, a large and growing body of scientific evidence demonstrates that intellectual and developmental effects occur among children whose blood lead concentrations do not exceed the existing limit. Studies published in recent years have shown that this exposure limit does not protect children from intellectual impairments. These impairments have been quantified as significant loss of points on IQ tests and other tests of brain function, cognitive ability, and normal psychological development. Researchers have also been able to quantify these impairments with academic aptitude tests, as well as academic achievement tests, such as those that school systems administer to assess children's performance in reading, math, basic subjects. Even more recently, a number of studies have demonstrated that these relatively lower exposures to lead are correlated or identified as a risk factor with attention deficit hyperactivity disorder, ADHD, and estimates are that this is a factor in as many as 300,000 cases of this condition among children nationwide. And as an economic note, public health literature also has put a cost per case estimate on ADHD as in the range of $15,000 per year. That's to families and the healthcare system. Also, along the lines of economics, I wanted to touch upon the cost effectiveness of what this legislation proposes. aside from preventing some of these cases of ADHD and other conditions, even today's lead exposure levels, which are lower than decades ago, are still costing the U.S. economy over $40 billion per year in lost productivity when children become adults of working age. And a proportional impact is felt here in Minnesota on our state's economy. So a more protective lead exposure limit like what is proposed would cut these losses and would represent a sound investment in the future of our state and our economy. As Senator Torres-Ray mentioned, there are disparities in today who is affected in terms of the exposure and health risk limit. So I'll just touch upon that briefly again. Although our society has made great progress in reducing the average blood lead levels among children, there are still hundreds of thousands of American children who are exposed to levels of lead that are now recognized as hazardous. Not all children are faced with these health risks and obstacles to success. African-American children as a group are the hardest hit, and more generally, children from lower-income households of any racial or ethnic background. And although lead paint can be found in all corners of the state, the problem is more concentrated in the inner cities. So in terms of what would happen when we change this number from 10 to 5 in a few discrete places in the statute, this would require a few simple and basic yet very cost-effective and important public health actions. So when a child's blood lead level exceeds 5 micrograms per deciliter, this would call for thorough family education on potential sources of lead and ways to avoid exposure, and a follow-up blood test for the exposed child and for other young children in the residence to make sure when you take one sample, which is really just a snapshot in time, so to speak, that you do a follow-up test to make sure that the measures were taken are sending that blood lead exposure back down, keeping it into the safer area, not rising up into the levels that we now know are more seriously dangerous. And in terms, just for purposes of clarity, in terms of what the bill does not do, Senate File 522 would not change or supersede higher regulatory thresholds already in place that require some of the more intensive interventions such as home inspections, chelation, medical treatment, and as you're probably aware, the Minnesota legislature changed some of those higher action thresholds a few years ago. Yet this lower threshold where the state recommends the most basic, inexpensive public health actions has remained the same. That's why we're characterizing this as unfinished business, not to in any way imply that our society is not doing anything for this. Of course, we recognize the great progress that we've made. We just don't want to leave a certain demographics and certain groups of children left out in the cold, still exposed to hazardous levels of lead. Now, I realize that what's on the screen right now is probably not going to be visible. This is a sheet that I included in the handouts for committee members. The purpose of putting it up here is just to demonstrate how focused this legislation is and how focused the proposal is to just look at a few actions out of the many actions that are required for various exposure levels of lead.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you, Mr. Yaman. Is there any questions for
Mr. Chairman?
Senator Hahn.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Doctor, I've got, a couple of questions for you. What is the number of children that have this exposure that have been determined to have this level of exposure in Minnesota in the last year?
Mr. Yum.
Mr. Chair, Senator Hahn, the estimates are a few thousand. I'm sure we could get an exact number from Minnesota Department of Health. And whether or not the actual exposure has occurred in the last year, I'm not sure if that's to you the important part of the question, but this would affect a few thousand children's health.
I'm sorry, Mr. Chairman, the noise is a little bit. Are you saying that there are 2,000 children that have been determined to have blood lead exposure greater than 5 milligrams in Minnesota? In the last year, that was determined. 2,000 children have higher than a 5 milligram blood concentration. Is that?
Mr. Chair, Senator, I believe the figure that I've read and been told is 5,000 children would be statewide between the 5 micrograms and the current standard of 10 micrograms. So we might not be every year having that number, but that's the current number that would be brought in under this proposal.
And Mr. Chairman, and is it Dr. Yam?
Mr.
Thank I'm sorry. I no called problem. You doctor before. I didn't want to promote you unnecessarily. But the number you're quoting, is that an estimate based on things, or is this a actual count where they've had patients come in and said, well, here's a patient that has this blood level. Can you tell me, is it an estimate or is it an actual count?
Mr. Chairman, I think Mr. Newman, Senator Hand, I think Mr. Newman will respond to your question, Senator Hand, and his presentation will address some of those questions as well.
Go ahead, Mr.
Chair, Senator Hahn. My name is Dan Newman. I'm the executive director of the Sustainable Resources Center. The 2007 blood lead level surveillance report issued by the Minnesota Department of Health shows that there were 6,577 blood lead tests out of 93,477 that had a blood lead level between 5 and 9.9. The vast majority of those were capillary tests rather than venous tests, and so the issue of how many of those capillary tests would actually show that same level of blood lead upon a venous test is where it becomes shaky as to how many children there actually are. Capillary tests are notoriously less reliable.
Okay. And Mr. Chairman, and I don't want to impede your presentation, but I did want to go back to Mr. Yaman's testimony too. A couple of points in your presentation, you talked about the harm of even blood lead levels under 10 milligrams. You said lower tests on IQ scores. What is the data? How much lower are we talking about? What is the number?
Mr. Chair, Senator, it's a statistically significant reduction. I would say offhand it's in the range of several points, 5 to 10 points. I would be glad to forward you the studies that have measured this.
Mr. Chairman, I would appreciate that. I think a 5 to 10 point reduction in IQ scores is highly significant. We had testimony on reducing mercury exposures a few years ago that talked about reduction in IQ scores that were significant, that were fractions of 1 point. So I'd be curious to see the studies that show it's 5 to 10 points. I would like to see that. Second thing related to that, you talk about that the exposures cost $40 billion per year, and in Minnesota over $1 billion. Where does that data come from?
Mr. Chair, Senator, the nationwide figures were published in the National Institute of Health Journal, Environmental Health Perspective, in 2002. Researchers assembled a panel to look at all the factors that would go into an estimate, looking at lost productivity when exposed children exposed at today's average levels of lead exposure entered the workplace. And then the Minnesota figure is an estimate that that I participated in with a few collaborating organizations to basically take that same methodology and apply it to Minnesota based on the Minnesota lead testing data.
that are available from our state health department.
And Mr. Chairman, I just want to clarify the methodology. As I mentioned before, a few years ago we had a bill that talked about mercury exposure, and there were similar claims being made, and I asked to look at the study that substantiated that, and they were basing the claim of loss of dollars to the economy on it related to the reduction in IQ scores. Is that the same methodology that's being used here?
Mr. Chair, Senator, it's slightly different, and this is another study where I'd be glad to forward it to you for a further look at the details beyond just the dollar figures or the you know boiled down findings from each one.
Well, and Mr. Chairman, I appreciate it, and I won't pursue this, but I think that this is an important question, and that if we're going to take action here, and I appreciate that this is not, at least from the testimony, not significant, although if we're going to be doing the blood testing, follow-up blood testing on 6,000 kids, there's a cost to that, and that's something we should understand what that cost would be. But what I'm trying to assess is what the hazard is and how valid the claims are of the that are being made here. And I think it's fine to come to a committee and say, well, we're going to see lower scores on IQs and we're going to have this higher cost. But if those are just claims that are being made by people without any real substantiation, I think that's important to know before we adopt the provisions of the bill, since that's the premise that it's based on. And so all I'm asking is that the assumptions that are leading this are fully exposed so that we can understand how clear they are. I mentioned the mercury problem. As I said, the study that I got to look at after the bill had been passed had some very tenuous relationships that were being linked together that were then being used to create projections that were then extrapolated. I mean, it was a very long and, I thought, tenuous relationship that was being held out that led to the claim that there were billions of dollars at stake in the economy. And I think it would be helpful to know how this claim is being substantiated so that we can understand whether that's the case here as well. So, Mr. Chairman, I don't want to take up too much more of the time here.
Mr. Chairman, if I may, I want to make sure that I clarify this to the members and to you, Senator Hahn. I intentionally did not accept a presentation from 10 other scientists because my intent here was not to really bring you the science and the opposition for one simple reason. This is a very small group of kids, one. Two, because although scientifically we could bring both groups to argue here and we probably could stay here for many, many hours and we will conclude that we really don't know enough. But there is something that we do know, and that is that from a scientific point of view, we know that the zero level is what we should be trying to achieve in our society because lead is poison. And zero is the level. As a society, we accepted that we can go for zero because we all have lead in our blood. So how high do we go? 40 years ago, we say 60. So if you died from lead, that was okay. But today, what we see, and that was a question that I asked from the scientist, is it realistic to really say that zero is what we should be striving for? They said no. So what is realistic? About two, but we have a significant number of children that are way above that. And when you look at the statistics of the children that have been tested, a lot of these children are very low-income children. So I think the significance here is really addressing the issue of who are these children and where do they live and why do we accept that while most of us and most of our children only have two, which is bad already, some have three, some have four. There is a group that have between five and 10. And so my intent was to bring this to your attention, that we should deal with this, and this is a very small group of kids that we can test today and do something about it so that we don't deal with significant health problems that are particularly related to their IQ later on in their lives. So I hope that we can make that clear through this testimony. But I do respect, of course, the science, and I will be happy to bring more of that information to this committee, but the intent here was to address something that we think is a significant problem for a very small population.
Well, and Mr. Chairman and Senator Torres-Ray, I appreciate that, and I appreciate you're not wanting to bring a bunch of scientists, and I wouldn't ask for that or expect that you would do that. I think your point about should we try to make this lead level lower for people because we can do that, and if there's virtually no cost to do it, then obviously we should. And that may be reason enough in and of itself, is that we can detect it, and it's better to have it lower than higher, so let's make it lower. But what troubles me is when we have claims that say, well, there's a relationship to IQ, which I'm not certain that there is, and I'm certainly not clear that it's 5 to 10 points. That would be, to me, very dramatic. And I would be, but I'd like to see it, and I hope that data will be provided. And if we talk about that if they have this exposure, there's a loss to the economy, but if that claim is based on very tenuous chains of circumstances that really almost you have to suspend your disbelief to put them all together. And then we're saying if we reduce it from, you know, 6 to 5 or 4 or something, that saves money. I'm just troubled by these claims and how well they're substantiated. And I'm not asking for there to be counterclaims brought in. I'm just saying that if we're saying that there's $40 billion, I'd like to know how we got to that number. If we're saying there's a reduction in IQ scores, I think we should know that. It doesn't detract from your point that if we can do this, we should maybe just do it. But let's not make wild claims about this that maybe aren't true. If they're true, then let's find out. And I do think the cost to do the follow-up that you're recommending should be a factor. We should know what the cost is, that if there's 6,000 or how many ever it is and we're going to do these things, what is that cost? And so I don't want you to come in with more scientists and have a full but I would like to get clarity on the claims and just what is the logic that is substantiated. So.
Senator Bergen.
Mr. Chairman and Senator Hahn, well, first of all, to Senator Torres-Ray, thank you for working on this. I worked on it many years ago when we first established the lead standard in law. And Senator Hahn, I can tell you that lead poisoning in children can cause mental retardation. It's been scientifically documented. Now, it doesn't cause mental retardation in every child that's exposed to lead, but it has caused mental retardation in some children. Depends on the length and the amount of the exposure. But clearly, the scientific evidence is on the side of the fact that it does damage the intellectual development of children.
And Senator
Head.
Mr. Chairman, Senator Berglund, I agree with you. It does cause problems. I think the point is, does an exposure of 5 milligrams cause that problem, or is it not cause the problem? The claim is being made that it has some effect on IQ and that there's a claim that having this exposure of 5 milligrams has a huge economic loss. I'm a little doubtful of those claims, and all I'm asking is that if that's true, that the evidence should be brought forward to present it. I haven't heard anybody say that 5 milligrams of lead causes mental retardation. That was not made as a claim. And I agree with you that it can at higher levels and certain lengths of exposure. But that's not what this bill is about. It's about a very, very low level. And the claim is that it has a very dramatic effect on IQ and a very dramatic effect on the economy. And I just think we shouldn't accept that because someone comes to the committee and says that's so without some evidence to make that claim more believable. Because on the face of it, to me, it's not believable.
Further discussion. Senator Higgins and Mr. Newman, did you have a testimony you wanted to give yet? You have not given yours yet, so we'll have yours in a minute. Senator Higgins.
Thanks, Mr. Chair. Senator Torres-Ray, I think in your opening remarks you said that there was minimal cost to doing this, maybe for our state budgets, but I was curious to know whether you had heard from any of the local governments who actually administer the program, because there would be large costs to them. And I know when I carried this bill, whatever year is that, I think I did it more than once, but that was an issue that we ran into. And so just wanted to warn you of that and see whether you'd had any discussions with the local public health departments and overall.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman and Senator Higgins. Yes, the one of the differences between some of the previous attempts to do some of this work and change this is that at this time we're only going with the number. And as you recall, the legislation is very clear about, it's in the bill, the language said that the commissioner will determine the areas of risk. We didn't change that this time, meaning that they will continue to target and they will continue to determine areas of risk. And if they have more money to expand, they will. One of the issues that we know today is that what we have learned is that we test the level of iron in children, and it will be easy for the clinics and the hospitals to begin to incorporate a test on lead. And if they know that it is from 5 to 10, then the clinics will begin to do that, and it doesn't cost them a lot more. But the intent here, we didn't change anything else in the legislation at this point. So the commissioner still has the discretion of determining, the areas where they will target. And we didn't change any of that in the legislation at this point. I don't know if I responded to your question, but we are not asking them to we did not change more language in the legislation to force this the Department of Health to expand, but just to continue to do the targeting, and then if they have the money and do the education piece is also an important piece, I think, that we also included in here. If you remember Mr. Yamin's presentation, there were two areas where we're telling parents more and more that this is an issue that they need to address and that they need to have their children tested. So we hope to expand awareness as well as we change that level. But we did request the fiscal note, and we are waiting for that.
And, Mr. Chair, do we get a local government fiscal note as well anymore? I know in the past years we've had discussions about requiring that, but I don't know if we do or not. No?
I
must have dreamed that. Okay.
We've talked about it many times.
Well, there.
But Mr. Chair and Senator,
I've gotten the local impact written into my fiscal notes a couple of times when I've requested it. I mean, I think there's some mechanism to do that. They've estimated that for me on fiscal notes. I don't know the exact rules or anything, but I know I read them and was sometimes alarmed.
Yeah, that's.
Yes, that's.
And Senator Higgins, my guess is that this will be going to Senator Berglund's committee, so perhaps at that point we will have a better understanding of the fiscal impact of this. But at this point, I don't have it.
Senator Higgins' point that we just found from fiscal, that Senator Laurie is pretty much right, that the forms do have a spot on them for local impact, and that it's just usually not filled out. Senator Berglund.
So, Mr. Chairman and Senator Torres-Ray, you would require the testing to be done to determine if the blood level is between 5 and 10, but you wouldn't be requiring cleanup. Is that what I'm hearing you say? So the parent would be notified if they felt like it had something to do with the environment and they were renting, they could move, but the future family might not be notified that there would be a lead issue necessarily in the property. Is that what I'm hearing you say?
That is correct. Mr. Chairman, Senator Berglund, that is correct. And the reason we're not going there is because of the significant, perhaps, fiscal impact. And if I get the support from the committee, I would be happy to expand on that. But at this point, we're just moving in the direction of changing the number.
Further discussion? Okay, Mr. Newman, welcome to the committee at last.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chair. As I said, my name is Dan Newman, Executive Director of the Sustainable Resources Center. SRC does lead poisoning prevention. We've done that for a dozen or so years. We receive grant funds through the Minnesota Department of Health that we use to match HUD dollars and funds available from AmeriCorps to deliver lead poisoning prevention, education outreach, and lead hazard control work across the state of Minnesota. We're in a significant number of counties each year. I just want to give you a brief description of the kind of programming that's done to prevent lead poisoning and then a statement about the why we think this is a good idea. In 2008, we did a blood lead screening for over 1,400 children in collaboration with health plans, public health agencies, and other nonprofits. We did 207 in-home visits with families whose children had a blood lead level of over 5. We did a variety of community events, health fairs, presentations, puppet shows. We have a remote testing van called Letty Eddie that goes around the state, provides an opportunity to test children, and we reached over 3,000 people across the state last year. In the realm of lead hazard control, we worked in 170 homes. We replaced 1,900 windows, and for your information, lead-painted windows are the primary source of lead in homes in Minnesota and the primary source of lead poisoning for children. Lead paint is a problem in our potential problem in every home built before 1978. When lead was taken out of architectural coatings. In essence, we go anywhere we're needed in the state of Minnesota where we're requested by a public health agency to do cleanup and to do education and interventions with families. Another thing I'd like to note is that parents, often we find that parents have unwittingly poisoned their children through renovation of their home, remodeling, disturbing lead paint. We just had a case last week from Renville County where a family, child tested above 10 with a blood lead level. They'd been working on their home, and they had created lead dust, and that had caused the poisoning. So it's a significant issue all across the state of Minnesota. As a state, as Samuel noted, we've made great progress, and we're testing more kids, and we're finding lower blood lead levels, and that's a really good thing, but we have a long way to go. What we know is that paying attention to this matters. If people are paying attention to lead, they're thinking about it, it matters in terms of the number of kids getting screened and the number of kids who have elevated blood lead levels. In the last year, our Director of Education and Outreach has been working with the Minneapolis Department of Health on a clinic outreach program, and they have visited over 25 clinics in high-risk areas to talk to the doctors and the clinic managers about lead poisoning prevention and intervention. And what we know is that health professionals pay attention to what the guidelines say. And if the guidelines say it's a problem at 10, they pay attention at 10. And if the guidelines say it's a problem at 5, they pay attention at 5. And so it matters a lot as to how people start looking at this and the resources that are made available to families. There are many things that families can do in their own home to reduce the risk of lead poisoning and lead exposure among their children. The ultimate solution is to get the lead out, but that's going to be a very expensive proposition. But shy of getting the lead out, there are things that families can do to protect themselves, and those are the things we want to make sure they're aware of. Thank you for the opportunity.
Thank you, Mr. Newman. Is the Sustainable Resource Center Twin Cities based, but you cover the whole state, I gather, from your testimony?
We go wherever we can get to, and if there's a elevated blood lead level and the public health agency needs some help, we go there. We also do a lot of community events. We're invited to Head Starts and community health fairs, and we make an annual trip to the big health fair in Grand Rapids, and we do a lot of stuff out there.
Thank you. Questions from the committee? Senator Dahl.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I guess I don't have a question, but I wanted to bring this out to the committee as well. Mr. Newman and I have been speaking about this issue, and he brought up the point that just about every home before 1978 has lead-based paint in it, or did at some point. And one of the ways of getting at this is through, you know, this bloodletting and trying to identify the children and then get to their homes. It seems to me that you know, we already know which homes they are. I've been into several, probably a couple thousand or more homes in the Twin Cities that are have lead. I know have lead-based paint because they've got multiple layers over multiple layers of paint in these windows. And now as we're going into these homes in the next couple of years to weatherize them, because they're the same houses that are going to need upgrades for weatherization, especially probably windows, we've been talking how do we get to combine our efforts between the process of weatherizing their homes and also take care of at the same time fact that they have lead around those windows. It seems to me we shouldn't be going in with one crew at one time with one pile of money and addressing one issue and then trying to come back and trying to find those same people another time a year later, 2 years later, or maybe not finding them at all. And it was been suggested that maybe we talk to our congressional delegation to figure out a way to get those piles of money that are out there that are coming in to be able to get them to work together. I mean, we need to have our federal delegation work on some language, I believe. And so the support we can get from members of this committee, if we're concerned about lead, I certainly would work with you on drafting a letter to get to our congressional delegation. And then there's another issue with LIHEAP, I guess, being able to move money over that gets used for this type of thing. So I'm bringing that up because I think we could use the support of any committee members concerned about lead to try another avenue besides, you know, this one here. Thank you.
Thank you, Senator Dell. Questions from the committee discussion?
Mr. Chairman.
Senator Hand.
Just one last, and I just wanted to ask Mr. Yaman if he would provide that information on the IQ and other claims in the presentation to the committee, and would that be done sometime, I guess, before we vote on this in the floor, assuming that we vote on it?
And you can say no.
Yeah. Mr. Chair, Senator, I would be glad to provide any information that's available to me. I just wanted to ask you the extent of what you would want and realistically have time to consider, and also note that I'm not asking you to take my word for these facts that I put on the sheet, that the purpose of citing the references is that those facts are from the scientific literature. So those are independent teams of scientists from around the U.S. and around the world that have made these findings and put their names on the line. So I could provide copies of the studies that I'm citing if that's what you're looking for.
Mr. Chairman and Mr. Yaman, yes, I'm just looking for that you made some claims in your presentation about significantly lower scores on IQ tests. You mentioned 5 to 10 points, and you talk about the $40 billion a year cost. And if there are studies that show that, then, yeah, I think I'd like to have you provide it.
Senator, is there anyone in the audience who wish to speak with concerns about the bill? Senator Lynch.
Mr. Chair, just for clarification, is this bill going to another committee after today?
Nobody is requesting unless finance, I'm assuming.
Yeah, we have to have it come to finance. The claim is that there is no or little fiscal impact, but we really need to see it in a fiscal note.
Senator Lynch.
Mr. Chair and Senator Torres-Ray, then, with that line of thinking, I'm not prepared to do this today, but it has, through our discussion, became apparent to me that the legislation, while I'm supportive of the legislation, it does impact the cities of the first class, and I have a city that is on the verge of becoming that city of the first class, and particularly on line 2.10, I am not well-versed on what we have in place in terms of soil surveys. And I see that there was, when this was adopted, there was some exception or some accommodation made to Minneapolis and St. Paul. And so I just bring that up as something that I'm going to check on and would like to potentially have further, may have further conversation or possible amendment to that. But I'll wait until your next stop.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman and Senator Lynch. Definitely, you know, the intent here really is to be more responsible and to open this to all the cities that may have this problem. We were very conservative here just simply because of these fiscal limitations, and I would have loved to, you know, go farther in terms of, you know, expanding the language and the coverage and all of that. But if this committee is supportive, we will certainly incorporate some changes to expand this to other areas.
Senator Torres-Ray moves Senate File 522 as not amended. Senate File 522 be recommended to pass and referred to the Committee on Finance. Is there further discussion? Not all those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Motion prevails. Thank you, Senator
Thank you,
Torres-Ray.
Mr. Chairman. Thank you, members.
Senator Pappas, welcome to the committee.
have some handouts. I know we had some earlier that was sent to your office, but here's some more.
Well, Senator Pappas is preparing, there's an amendment to put the bill in the shape the author wishes, and Senator Higgins, would you be willing to move the technical author's amendment? On that motion, any discussion? Not all those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Motion prevails.
Sorry, Mr. Chairman, we're having conversation here. Did you just adopt the A1?
Yes, the bill is in the shape you wanted it.
Yes, thank you very much. Mr. Chairman, what this legislation will do is it will not permit smoking in a motor vehicle when transporting a child who is under the age of 18. And I want to mention that in the Freedom to Breathe Act that we passed a couple years ago, there is a provision that vehicles that are used in work, like company cars, smoking is not allowed in those vehicles. So between the Freedom to Breathe Act and this particular provision in the Freedom to Breathe Act, we do have a precedence affecting cars. Now here we're really talking about children who are the most vulnerable to secondhand smoke. And we have several people who are going to testify about the health consequences to children under age, and it's particularly under age 18 that those are the children. This is a secondary offense, members, so in terms of the whole issue of our concern of profiling, a police officer or a traffic officer can't pull a car over because they notice there is smoking going on with children in the car. But if there is a moving violation, then they could be cited for the smoking violation. We're really not trying to catch parents. We're really trying to educate parents. And it's just been my experience over the years that Minnesotans are law-abiding, and that if you do say it's a law, then people tend to obey the law, even if the consequences are fairly minimal. Minnesota will not be the first state to pass such a law. I had a student in a meeting I had with students from St. Scholastica, who is from Canada, and she said Canada actually has outlawed smoking in vehicles with children, as has Arkansas, Louisiana, Maine, and California. And it's passed the North Dakota Senate, the Republican North Dakota Senate, and will be heard in the Republican North Dakota House this week. Nine other states are considering smoke-free cars for their kids in bills this year. And based on the Minnesota Student Survey, 300,000 children are regularly exposed to secondhand smoke in cars. So this is really a very serious problem for many children. So I think I have the order right of the testifiers. Is this Phyllis Sloan?
Okay, Phyllis.
We're going to do the video first.
Oh, we're going to do the video first. Yes. Somebody know how to do that?
Yes.
We have a short video to show the committee. Don't you love technology? It's okay. We can all take time to breathe, take a deep breath.
We can put a microphone near the speaker.
Using a car equipped with specialized monitors, scientists like Dr. Clevites from Stanford University conduct demonstrations that are able to measure in real time the dangerously high levels of fine particulate matter inside a car that a person is. research shows what happens when a cigarette is smoked in a stationary car with the driver's window either open or closed.
Signature, yeah.
Within seconds of a smoker lighting up inside the car, monitors in the front and back seat measure dramatic increases in the levels of particulate matter from secondhand smoke inside the car. Within even after the cigarette is put out, the toxic levels of secondhand smoke remain beyond the EPA's hazardous level for several minutes. Scientific tests show that the air quality in a car while someone is smoking is dangerous whether the windows are open or closed. Surprisingly, the pollution levels caused by smoking in a car can far exceed the pollution coming from the cars around you.
Here we have the side pack particle monitor. That's measuring the air in the front seat of this car as we're driving down Sunset Boulevard. The levels are very clean. We really don't see any pollution at all, even though there's cars all around us driving around and we have the windows open. So our smoker has just lit a cigarette. We have all the windows partially or completely open. You can see the levels are actually starting to increase just from the cigarette. From the background green clean level now to yellow red level, which is getting up towards the unhealthy or very unhealthy level on the EPA index. So this is just from a single cigarette being smoked just for a few seconds in the front seat. Now we're actually above getting up towards the hazardous level, which is above 250 micrograms. So as the smoke swirls around the front seat, anybody sitting in the front seat or the back seat will still be exposed to an elevated level unhealthy by the EPA.
Driving with all the windows closed, except for the driver's window open approximately 6 inches, the results are similar.
I was going off this scale, 1,000 micrograms, and that is over the EPA limit for hazardous, which is only 250 micrograms.
Secondhand smoke will also pool in the back seat, often exposing children to high concentrations of dangerous particles that linger in the air.
Certainly as a pediatrician, I'm particularly sensitive to the unique vulnerability of children to secondhand smoke. Certainly pound for pound, they breathe more air in on a minute by minute basis, so that in any given environment, children are actually sucking in more air pollution than adults in the same environment. And secondly, of course, they are still in a developing phase. When they're exposed to toxins like fine particulate matter that's in cigarette smoke, it is damaging to their lungs, and those damages can last throughout their lifetime.
The scientific evidence is clear. Smoking in cars poses serious health risks. Even one cigarette smoked inside a car is shown to produce dangerously high levels of pollution that is unhealthy to breathe, regardless of whether the car is parked or moving through traffic, windows open or windows closed. Children, who are often just along for the ride, are especially vulnerable. To protect children from this danger, California passed the Smoke-Free Cars with Minors Law, prohibiting smoking a cigarette, pipe, or cigar in a moving or parked vehicle while minors 17 and under are present. To learn more, please visit tobaccofreeca.com.
Okay, who's going first?
Welcome to the committee. Please identify yourself for the record.
Good morning. Afternoon. Excuse me. We've been here a while. Thank you, Chairman Marty and committee members. My name is Phyllis Sloan. I guess I'm supposed to be here today, but you have a hard piece before you. All of these health-related things have struck me just very deeply. You spoke of colorectal cancer. We had a former board chair
3 years ago passed at the age of 54 due to that, and on 2 weeks ago, I had another child advocate friend the same thing at age 57. You spoke of lead with children, and just numbers of the children have high levels of lead in low-income communities, and that's certainly something that myself as a child care provider sees on a regular basis, and far too many licensed and unlicensed child care providers see in inner-city programs as well. And now smoking in cars with children. I'm before you today because I represent a nonprofit organization in near North Minneapolis, La Creche Early Childhood Centers, which is an anchoring organization that has been in the community for some, 40 plus years, since 1969. And numbers of families within the near North community bring their children to La Creche. At present, there are 117 children from 66 parents, and of those 117 children across two sites, there are 15 asthma action plans in place for children. And as you're aware, health disparities, there's such a discrepancy in low-income communities, and for children with an asthma action plan in place, it's very serious. Asthma, as you know, can kill. It took the life of our former superintendent of schools in New York, Richard Green, who was a high school principal of mine. Teachers and early care providers are using nebulizers, much like people use thermometers at home with their children. So the bill before you again, smoke-free cars for kids, is close to my heart. Over this past year, alongside efforts conducted throughout our community, a core group of La Creche parents and staff have been learning much about the impacts of secondhand smoke, or ETS, environmental tobacco smoke, on the lives of young children, infant through school age for us, up until age 10 years, but specifically 5 years of age. Again, health disparities are great in low-income communities, and the majority of our families are 87% low-income and single heads of households. So we are seeing numbers of respiratory-related illnesses along with chronic ear infections. Heaven forbid, many of you are, all of you, probably aware of SIDS, sudden infant death syndrome, which all early care and education providers must be informed about and receive education on and training for before they step into two classrooms. So all around us, because of the nature of the sensitivity of health with young children, are matters that, again, are connected somewhat to smoke. This brings to mind kind of what rights do children have, what responsibility or roles do caregivers have, and certainly legislators, in limiting behavior at the expense of a child's health. What value do we place on protecting children, and should it be a priority? And I believe that it must be, as I'm sure you do, and that children's health is not negotiable. As adults, I believe this is a responsibility and a sacred privilege to guide and protect the innocence, health, and well-being of all children. And children that we all know, they learn most by not necessarily what we say, but by what we do, and how in relationship we are an example to them if we're walking our talk, or heaven forbid, if we're sitting in a vehicle with them and smoking and telling children not to smoke, meanwhile they're taking in that. Secondhand smoke also, as record for some of the things that we've learned, the toxins are incredible. You know, to hear formaldehyde and ammonium and cyanide and arsenic are some of the toxins within cigarette smoke, and that cigarettes, as much as people are smoking them and having one portion of it close to their face, it's the piece that's away that's causing the smoke that's getting into the air and causing problems, particularly with the health of young children. So I was just watching along with you this video, and a thought came to mind that it hadn't come to mind for me before. Even if the child's not in the car and that car seat's there, you know, that car seat is picking up the smoke. And it would be like your or my jacket or blazer just being filled with smoke and, you know, over our nose at all times. So I'd like for us to consider those kinds of things as well. Bodies are all different. Again, there's lots of health-related matters before you this morning, and young bodies we know can take less and oftentimes are made sicker sooner and more frequently. And young brains are developing, and we want to make sure that they develop positively, and we certainly know because of all the research with brain development that it takes clean air and oxygen to do that. So we all need work together in a positive manner to support and to take these things into account around children's health. One of the parents in our advisory once questioned about children being in a situation where smoke is all around them and that they are in tight quarters. Now, you will understand, you know, there are smokers and there are non-smokers. And certainly, again, we have 66 families, and it's divided. About one-third of them are smokers. But it was a smoker, one of the moms, who said, you know, would you basically extend to your child and you'll forgive me because the image is great. I kind of coined her Steven Spielberg, but would you extend to your child a bag of cancer? I ask you, again, to consider all of these important matters in relationship to this issue of smoke in cars and to look at it as us looking at increasing health opportunity for children and increasing environmental conditions for all of us, children and adults. It's our youngest citizens. They will be our and your next constituents, and just very important, again, that they fully have all that they need in order to contribute in a manner which we would all expect that they would rise to. So, again, thank you, Chair and Committee, for allowing us this opportunity.
Thank you, Ms. Long. Sir Papaswich, who's next?
My name is Joel Clayback, and I'm 11 years old, and I have asthma. I have to make a lot of sacrifices in order to keep my asthma under control. When I was younger, I had to take a lot of medicine. I wasn't allowed to go out for recess when the air was bad. I couldn't go to birthday parties at homes, bowling alleys, or restaurants where smoking was allowed. Because of my sacrifices, I was able to stop taking medicine. A few years ago, my dad got remarried to someone who smokes. She doesn't smoke in the house, but she does smoke in the car. I really like seeing my dad, but I am tired of getting sick from the breathing in stinky cigarettes. I have talked to my dad and his new wife about how secondhand smoke makes me sick, but they never believe me. I get terrible headaches, and sometimes breathing is really hard. After a weekend with my dad, I sometimes have a hard time at school because my head hurts and I don't feel good. I took a petition to my school and asked a lot of my friends if they supported smoke-free cars for kids, and 36 of my friends signed the petition. Adults should not have the right to do whatever they want around us kids. This law would not help me and all other kids whose parents do not believe that their smoking hurts us. So please vote yes on smoke-free cars for kids.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Very good job. Dr. Hillinger.
As a pediatrician, it's great to be upstaged by a child. Thank you for your testimony. My name is Dr. Ed Ellinger. I'm a pediatrician and president of the West Metro Medical Society, an organization representing over 4,000 physicians in the West Metro area. I'm also the immediate past chair of the Public Health and Preventive Medicine Committee of the Minnesota Medical Association and director of Boynton Health Service at the University of Minnesota. While none of these organizations have taken a position on this bill, my testimony emanates from my experiences with each of those organizations. Recognizing that tobacco use is our number one public health problem and seeing the devastating physical and economic effects of tobacco use and secondhand smoke not only on their patients but on their family members and members of their community, physicians have been actively pursuing ways to reduce tobacco use and eliminate exposure to secondhand smoke. For years, physicians have helped their patients quit smoking. However, they recognize that a broader community effort is needed to keep people from initiating smoking. That is why physicians have long supported statewide tobacco use prevention efforts. And as data mount on the toxic effects of exposure to secondhand smoke, physicians have also increasingly recognized the public health importance of the state's Clean Indoor Air Act and the Freedom to Breathe Act. They have supported these efforts because they help protect the rights of everyone to be able to breathe clean and safe air, particularly those, like workers in bars and restaurants, who have no choice about the quality of the air that they breathe. The bill before you today supports that same philosophy, that everyone has the right to breathe clean air, particularly those who can't choose the quality of the air that they breathe. And what more captive and vulnerable population is there than children in automobiles? Because of their higher metabolic rate and where they sit, children are a group most negatively affected by secondhand smoke in cars. And as you have heard, the toxic chemicals from secondhand smoke in cars rapidly rise to dangerous levels and remain high even after smoking has ceased. Passing this bill would help eliminate a significant toxic chemical exposure for an extremely vulnerable population. But this bill would do a lot more than that. As a pediatrician and the director of a student health service, I see the influence that public policies have on the establishment of social norms that impact the cognitive, behavioral, and ethical development of children and young adults. Policies have a direct effect on the individual, but they also set the norms of behavior in our society that help educate children and young adults about what is appropriate behavior. This bill would help establish and solidify the norm that exposure to secondhand smoke is a significant public health risk. It would help teach children that they have some responsibility to help protect the health of their neighbors. It would help model the fact that people's actions have an impact on the broader society. This bill would also have an impact on the level of smoking in our society. Most smokers want to quit, adding another reinforcing message that their tobacco use not only affects them, but those around them will be another incentive to help move smokers closer to their goal of quitting. As a pediatrician, a public health physician, and a grandfather, I encourage you to pass this piece of legislation. It is good public health policy that will affect the health of vulnerable children and help improve the overall health of our state now and far into the future. Thank you.
Thank you, Doctor. There are questions from the committee. Not Ms. Vitale?
Patricia.
Good afternoon. My name is Latricia Vitale, and I work in North Minneapolis at a community clinic, North Point Health and Wellness Center, that's been there for about 40 years, and I work on a project that educates African-American women on having smoke-free homes and cars and the dangers of smoke-free homes and cars. In 2007, we did focus groups where we targeted African-American pregnant women and new mothers in North Minneapolis. We targeted African-American women leaders in North Minneapolis, African-American girls, school-age girls, primarily high school girls, and we also targeted African-American women in North Minneapolis who belong to a faith-based group or organization. The biggest finding that we had in the focus groups were that the women were educated. They knew the dangers of secondhand smoke. They knew the effects that it had on the children, but they didn't have the negotiation tools to say, hey, don't smoke in my car. They didn't feel empowered to say. The girls didn't feel empowered to say to their parents, I mean, what child is going to tell their parent, don't smoke around me and not get in trouble? Well, with the exception of him. But but in these groups, the girls felt like, I have to live with it. And then with the women, they felt like they would lose their man if they said, you can't smoke in the car. So it, to me, this bill would be the ultimate empowerment for these women. I mean, who wants to pay a fine for smoking in the car? Now you don't have to say that we're, you know, not that we're killing the kids isn't enough, but, you know, we're going to have to pay now if, you know, if we get pulled over for a moving violation and we're smoking in the car. So I'm here in support and feeling that this is the ultimate empowerment for these women. And having this would do that. We know that Minnesotans, we are law-abiding citizens. And so for me, if we have this law, we'll stop it.
Thank you, Ms. Vita.
Thank you.
Okay, finally.
And we're Minnesota nice, so it's yes. Often very hard for people to say, I do mind. My name is Pat McCone. I'm the Director of Mission Programs for the American Lung Association of Minnesota, based out of our Duluth office. Thank you, Chair Marty, for this opportunity and committee to speak to you. This is amazing. Great testimony. We're not alone, and I think that's important. I also felt that the discussion before this on lead, it's interesting to hear those comments around indoor air quality and lead, because lead is contained in secondhand smoke, and we no more want to have lead poisoning from paints than we want lead in the air and breathed in with children. And then I was also interested in the questioning around the science, because I brought the science along. And the science is clear. Secondhand smoke kills. Secondhand smoke causes many, many diseases, and we're only learning more. The Surgeon General's report from a very conservative administration also put out a brochure, and I think you were handed this, on what to do around issues of secondhand smoke. My only regret, it didn't say what can lawmakers do. It talked about what can parents do, what can communities do. But I think the challenge is it's not either or, but and, but it's both and. Lawmakers have an influence here in decision to make also. From the Lung Association's point of view, we know that as incidence of asthma are increasing, 1 in 15 children in our state have asthma. Asthma is like most equal opportunity diseases. It is more prevalent among the poor, as is smoking. The tobacco industry knows that and continues to market disproportionately to the poor. We are not alone. We found that out in some survey work we did in northeastern Minnesota, where we pride ourselves on independence and not telling us what to do. In St. Louis County, Carlton County, and Lake County, we did a recent survey of 400 residents. 89% of them told us that it bothers them when they see a child in a car and adults smoking. 76% of them told us they don't allow that in their own vehicles. And two-thirds of us rangers said, we would support restrictive measures or regulations protecting children in cars. We are not alone, as mentioned before. We're not the cutting edge. Arkansas, Louisiana, California, and Maine have all passed legislation protecting children in cars ahead of us. And there are 9 other states in that dialogue, including North Dakota, where I'm actively involved with that community, passed through the Senate, led by a group of children. Freedom to Breathe does protect workers in car environments. It's time to strengthen that. And in this time of economic hardship, what a nice thing to be able to do, pass positive health care saving legislation without a cost. We're not asking for a dime. I, along with the thousands of Minnesotans, are ready for this. We encourage you very strongly to pass this legislation.
Thank you, Ms. McComb. Senator Pappas.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. We'll take any questions.
Questions from the committee. Senator Berglund.
Mr. Chairman and Senator Pappas, does the police officer that issues a citation have to see the driver smoking or someone else in the car smoking?
My answer would be, we might need to have legal counsel answer that, but I would say yes, because it's a secondary offense. If they're stopped with a moving violation, then they would have to physically see the person smoking. But we could ask our legal counsel.
And two things. One, this bill is going to Judiciary Committee. And number two, the definition of smoking you have includes carrying a lighted smoking thing. So, I mean, you would see that unless they extinguish it quickly. But Senate Counsel or Research, want to comment on that?
Mr. Chairman, I think that would be a question for the Judiciary Committee, which I believe is going to see this bill. So their counsel would probably know more about that than we would.
Senator Torres Ray.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Senator Pappas, I believe in the intention that you have here, and I believe in the reasons for why you bring this to our attention, and I would probably support your effort. But I am very concerned about some of the consequences that this type of action may bring. I sincerely disagree with Ms. Letitia Vetta. The ultimate empowerment is not to give a license to an officer, to give a ticket to a woman to understand that she needs to stop smoking. The ultimate empowerment is that we provide funding so that these young women never start smoking. That is the ultimate empowerment, and we haven't done that. And so I, on one hand, understand the reasons for why you are bringing these to our attention, and I may support you on your effort. I want to make clear that we have never invested, really, in this effort, and we have never invested in education and trying to educate our young people about smoking. And now we are attempting to modify behavior to law enforcement. And for me, this is a concerning issue because African-American people and Latino people, I believe, will be stopped more often than other people. And that they will be issued a citation, and I believe that many Latino people will be asked about their immigration status just because they were smoking. And I don't know this, Senator Pappas, because I can't predict the future, but I have some history, and I am concerned about that. So I know that this is not your intent, and I know that your intent is to protect children, and that's why I will support you. But I do think that we need to be aware of those facts, and we need to take that into consideration. We need to do more to invest in this area for prevention, and we're not doing enough. And I wish that we could also have conversations about that.
Mr. Chairman.
Senator Pappas.
And Senator Torres-Ray. I feel like we've tried to be very sensitive to this issue, and I also represent a district that has a lot of low income as well as a lot of immigrants and people of color. And although we haven't had as big an issue with the St. Paul Police as Minneapolis has, it certainly is a concern, which is why we very purposely have made it a secondary offense so that the person would have to have a moving violation. They would have to run a red light, run a stop sign, make some kind of illegal driving violation before they could be stopped. And only then, if the officer noticed that they were holding a lighted cigarette or were smoking a cigarette and there were children in the car, could they then get the additional violation, citation. The purpose here really is to, in a way, empower people to say, well, I have to obey the law. Not to catch people and add more citations to an officer's list.
Senator Dahl.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Senator Pappas, what would be the fine then? If what is the penalty?
Up to Mr. Chairman and Senator Dahl, it's up to $100.
Okay, thank you, Mr. Chair. I guess the more I hear about all the secondhand smoke things, and I'm looking at this chart that we'd save $215 million a year if we just banned smoking, period, and just said it's so dangerous that we shouldn't even have the substance. Maybe instead of being piecemeal about it, maybe we should just say it's such a bad substance that we should eliminate it. I don't know if obviously the politics of that would be very difficult to get over. It certainly seems like it saves us a lot of money, but I'm a little concerned too about
a lot of problems for me on Christmas and Thanksgiving. I have cousins who smoke.
I have a few folks doing that too, and it would be hard to stop that. But I'm concerned about this bill too. That if you have a car seat and you don't have you can't tell if there's a baby in there or a child in there from driving. I know it's a secondary violation, but if that's the they see someone smoking at the state patrol, for instance, and they see that there's a car seat in there, you don't know if there's a baby or not in there, but that becomes the more of the impetus. Well, we just pull this person over anyway, just to see. Are you concerned at all that that's going? As Senator Torres-Ray is saying, that it becomes a reason to stop people.
I think we'd have to look at the what the statistics have been with seatbelts, because seatbelts have been a secondary offense for a long time. I do recall just a personal experience where I think I had lost a headlight and I wasn't aware of it, and I got pulled over. And just for my own comfort, I released my seatbelt. And the officer said to me, were you aware that you didn't have a headlight, you know, blah, 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 and, oh, you're not wearing your seatbelt. And I said, I just undid it. I really had it on, you know. And he did not cite me for the seatbelt, just for the, he gave me a warning, I think, for the headlight. So, I mean, it's just my personal experience. I don't know that we've had, I don't know what the experience has been with seatbelts. I really haven't heard people complaining to me that they've been pulled over just for the seatbelt violation, while it's been a secondary offense.
Mr. Chair, since you bring that up, I have actually been pulled over for that reason. I, you know, there's several police officers, kind of like a speed trap. At an intersection, and they pulled us over. Officer walked over to my vehicle, just wanted to check to see if you're wearing your seatbelt, you can go. And so I don't, you know, this is before I was a little, not quite as savvy on this stuff, but I think, you know, those things could happen, and it concerns me. It's just another reason to pull people over. I mean, if they're violating traffic laws, one thing, but to police people for whether they're smoking in their car or not. Not that I'm, again, I think we discussed this. I'm not trying to protect smokers. I believe that it's dangerous, and especially for children. I'm concerned about smoking in apartment buildings and things like that. Especially this time of the year, I don't care if they crack their door open or not. That smoke's coming back in the house. I question whether how dangerous it is, because I do know that there's a lot less smokers than there were, you know, 50 years ago. You know, where it seems every movie you watched, everybody had a cigarette in each hand, and every scene had a cigarette, and everybody smoked, and they probably smoked in their cars, and you know, in the hospitals and everywhere else. I don't know if that we have a significant, you know, amount of cancer rising out of that time period or not, but. Nonetheless, I know it's not healthy, but I something like this, I don't know how well we'd be able to really, you know, enforce it, and if we're going to get the effect we want, or if it's just going to be a means for police officers to have another reason to stop folks that, you know, that they may not otherwise pull them over.
Mr. Chairman and Senator Dahl, once again, you were not given were you wearing your seatbelt at the time? Mm-hmm. Well, the police officer wasn't really supposed to pull you over to check that. You know, I mean, I think we're always going to have some police officers that will abuse their power, and that definitely needs to be reined in. But our intention is that it's a secondary offense. It's more of an educational tool, so that parents know that it's very dangerous and it's against the law for them to smoke in cars with their children.
Senator Hand, then Senator Higgins.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, and Senator Pappas, or maybe one of your testifiers. There's been testimony about the effects, the health effects, and I don't want to get into a debate about that because maybe there is some debate about it. I think there is, but setting that aside, it would seem to me that children are going to be exposed to secondhand smoke much more often, for much greater length of time, and much more intensely in their home. They're in their home 60-70% of the time during a day. They may be in a car a few minutes every day, or maybe an hour or something. But why wouldn't we want to extend this to homes? If the concern is the health effects of secondhand smoke, it would seem to me by preventing it in a car would do very little in the overall picture of a family where there are smokers that have small children or children under the age of 18, that this would have virtually no detectable effect on their health conditions if they were being exposed to this at home. So why wouldn't we not want to extend this to homes?
Mr. Chairman and Senator Hahn, and I certainly welcome any of my testifiers or any committee members if you want to join in this discussion. My feeling is that it is far more customary for us in our society to regulate cars. We require licenses. We require cars to be licensed. We require car insurance. We require seat belts. Obey the safety rules. We require car seats. So I think that we have a lot more governmental authority to regulate what happens in cars than we do in people's homes. certainly we hope that the educational process of telling people they shouldn't smoke in cars and that you can't smoke in bars and restaurants and public places will eventually educate people that it's also dangerous for them to smoke in closed homes as well. But I have no intention of going there. My interest is children and cars.
Well, and Mr. Sure, Chairman, and I think you're right, Senator Pappas, we do have much more regulation with respect to cars. However, most of that regulation centers around the safe operation of the vehicle or safety in the vehicle. The argument being made here is one of general health about an activity that happens to be occurring in a car, but we had bills, as you know, a few years ago talking about eliminating this in bars and other places, and prior to that to public places. And I remember there was even discussion during those periods of time to say, well, this just has to do with bars and places where people are employed. As I recall, there was discussion at that time brought up about smoking in cars and homes, and it was denied that that was where we were going to go. And now here we are. And so my point is, if we're going there, kind of to Senator Dahl's point, why don't we just go there? I don't buy the logic that there's a health aversion that's taking place by doing this if we're not willing to ban it in homes as well. That, to me, doesn't make sense. If the health risk is there to children under age 18, it would seem to me that not permitting it in a car when they may be exposed to that very intermittently and permitting it in the home, that just the logic doesn't make sense. So I guess I would offer the amendment just to let's, you know, maybe on line one, six, after the word in, delete the rest, put Minnesota, delete section B.
Are you making that motion, Senator Hahn?
Yes.
Mr. Chairman, I would not support that motion.
Senator Hahn moves on page one, line six, after, after in, insert the word Minnesota and strike the rest of the.
Chairman Marty, that's correct, and also line then 1.7 through 1.10.
Right, through the rest of the bill, in effect, other than through line 14.
Mr. Chair?
Senator Higgins.
Mr. Chair, I have a question for Senator Hahn. If this amendment is adopted, are you going to vote for this bill?
Mr. Chairman and Senator Higgins, I'll think about it, but I'm just asking for there to be some honesty here about this issue. We're talking about a health risk that is severe, and we're saying that we can affect that health risk by banning that activity in a circumstance that's hardly consequential to the risk. And so I'm just saying that if it is a risk that we say it is, then we ought to be serious about it and do this.
Senator
so
Hahn,
to the extent that people think it's serious, they should vote for this.
Senator Hahn, I think the cigarette smoke concentration in a closed automobile is about 10 or 20 times what it is in a house.
Well, and Mr. Chairman, that may be true or it may not be. Depends on maybe the circumstances of the house, whether they have windows open or air conditioning or other factors or how many people are smoking or how much. I don't know. It may be true, it may not be true, but the point is children live in their homes, sleep there, they're exposed to secondhand smoke 60-70% of the day. They're in a car for a few minutes, maybe back and forth from school or on an errand. The health risk to being in the car, if you eliminate that, would not be consequential if you accept the argument. So just out of, if this is the purpose, then we ought to do this. And whether or not I will vote for it, Senator Higgins, I'll think about it.
Mr. Schlebeck said that he has asthma and he rides in the car with his father once in a while and also stays at your father's house once in a while, I assume?
Yes.
Is it, where do you have the most problem with your asthma?
Wherever there's smoking, I guess.
Okay. So it's about the same in your mind in the car or the house?
Yes.
Or is it worse in one or the other?
It's pretty much the same.
Okay. Is there, Senator Erickson Ropes?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And maybe to you or counsel, I'm just wondering if this is germane to the narrow scope of the bill, if we're talking about smoking in cars. And I appreciate your point, Senator Hannah. I think this deserves a standalone bill. If you'd be willing to chief author that, it might be interesting to have some conversation about to what extent we want to consider safety standards in people's homes related to secondhand smoke, but it seems that Senator Pappas is talking about a pretty narrow scope here. I wonder if attaching an amendment that would essentially, if I'm understanding it, open it up to the entire state of Minnesota, into people's private homes, and into every kind of enclosed space, public or private. I think I'm understanding the amendment correctly, so I'm wondering if it's... It sounds like more of a huge bill that you're attaching on to her little amendment.
Mr. Chairman, Senator Erickson, I'm just, again, to Senator Sagan's point, I'm not sure if I agree with this, because I'm not sure if I agree with the premise to some of these things that we're proposing to do. But people clearly do believe the premise, and they believe that it is a dangerous thing. And my point is simply that the exposure of children in cars to smoke is certainly there, but in terms of the health risk, the exposure of those children in their home has got to be much greater. And so if the argument is that this is a health problem, which this is a health committee, then that's the problem we should focus on. And so my amendment would certainly do that. It would extend to, we already have no smoking in public buildings, publicly owned buildings. We have no smoking in privately owned public buildings, or I don't know if that's the right way to call it. There are smoking bans in outdoor areas now that are near buildings or in parks and so forth. And to Senator Dahl's point, if this is the problem it is, then let's just have people vote to ban it entirely or drop the argument. If it's a health risk, then deal with it. Let's not do something symbolic that doesn't address that health risk.
Senator Erickson-Ropes, we do not generally enforce, in Senate tradition, do not enforce germaneness rulings in committee. Okay. And so his amendment, while it does substantially change the nature of the bill, is legitimate. So if he wants to pursue his motion, we will vote on it.
Okay.
Senator Erickson-Ropes.
Thank you. Then, Mr. Chair, perhaps you can advise me, since this seems to be a unique amendment, and I don't know that I've been presented with such a broad scope before in terms of the amendment. We don't have anyone here to testify to for or against Senator Hand's amendment, and I'm not sure, you know, where the science is, Senator, which is what you're looking for as well.
Well, Mr. Chairman, that's my point. We've heard testimony about the science of secondhand smoke right here that says it is dangerous, kills people, and if it does it by minimal exposure in cars, it's certainly doing it to a much greater degree in people's homes. And so we've heard the testimony, and my amendment would simply say, if that's true, then let's do the right thing and ban it.
Mr. Chairman.
Senator Pappas.
Mr. Chairman and members, because it wasn't my intention to ban smoking in homes, I don't have any statistics on that. I don't know what the studies are. But when a cigarette is lit in a car, it takes a mere 20 seconds for the air quality inside the vehicle to become more than 10 times more toxic than the level the U.S. EPA says is hazardous for breathing. I mean, the volume wasn't very good on the DVD, but that's the point that they made, is that, you know, it is more dispersed in a home or outside or in a building. Obviously, it's secondhand smoke and it's toxic, but it's very, very concentrated in a car. So this is a very narrow bill, and I would just prefer to keep it in its original form, and I would urge members to vote no on Senator Hahn's amendment.
Senator Lori.
Mr. Chair, it may be that we don't enforce germane questions, but I guess it would help me when deciding whether or not to support such an amendment to know what Chapter 169 is in statute. You know, I mean, because we'd be saying we should add in Chapter 169 that there'd be no smoking in the state of Minnesota. Is that something that would even be reasonable for us to?
It is. Yeah, it is traffic regulation. It is not the appropriate place for it. The simple way to deal with this is, if Senator Hand wishes to push his motion, we would vote on it, and then we can move forward. So is there further discussion of his motion to amend?
Mr. Chairman.
Senator Hand.
And I would be willing, Mr. Chairman, to take Senator Lori's advice and move it to change that reference in the section to the right place if we do succeed in passing this. But again, to the argument, we had a big discussion about smoking in bars and restaurants and bowling alleys, which are not nearly as confined as cars, and we deemed that to be a health risk to people who were patrons, even in closed in areas that were separated by walls or, you know, barriers that wasn't sufficient. And so we determined that was a health risk. And that was the argument to ban it from bars, restaurants, and places of public accommodation. And now we're saying that cars, which are more enclosed, is also one. And it just seems to me that if that science is sound and the logic is sound, this is the time to say, then let's just do it. Let's quit. I mean, I think the argument before was, well, homes are private spaces and cars are private spaces and there's a privacy thing and let's let people govern their lives. It seems like we're crossing that threshold now, and so I'm just asking for people who should cross it to let's just cross it and not draw a line that is not really a reasonable distinction.
Mr. Hand, two points I'd like to make before we vote on your thing. First of which is there are many things in Minnesota that you or I may consider dangerous that we don't ban for adults, but we frequently ban them around children. And I think that yours is to ban smoking in Minnesota as opposed to ban smoking in a enclosed area where children are present, where there are very high concentrations of secondhand smoke. And the other point I'd like to make, because you keep saying nobody was talking about vehicles, well, the bill that passed, Senator Sharon's bill a year or two ago, did ban smoking in vehicles when they're during hours of operation, during hours of work, if more than one person is present. So if you're doing it as part of your job, when more than one person is present, it is banned already. So it's not that cars are new. But.
Mr. Chairman, you're right, and I could be wrong, but my recollection was in the course of that discussion, there was talk about, well, why don't we extend this then to cars, since we talk about it with cars as part of employment and so forth. Anyway, that's kind of a peripheral issue. But what I'm trying to get at is that if, and again, going back to Senator Dahl's point, that we should do this if it's the right thing to do or not do it if it isn't. But I don't know what the logic is to say banning it in cars when that is such a minor part of what is, at least as I've heard to be the testimony, it's such a major problem. So I would offer my amendment.
On Senator Hand's motion, all those in favor say aye.
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 Opposed?
No.
Motion does not prevail.
I'll move the bill.
Senator Berglund moves the bill. I'll quickly ask, is there anybody in the audience who wish to speak with concerns about the bill?
Aye.
Sir, welcome to the committee. Please identify yourself and you'll be able to testify in a second. Senator Lynch.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just an irony here. And I'm very supportive of the educational component and the comments supporting that along the way, Mr. Chair. I think it's rather ironic, and I would just remind members that we had an opportunity in Minnesota to entertain that educational component via the tobacco endowment money. And we did some of that. But clearly, the decisions that were made in that area have come back in a way that was perhaps not anticipated or was anticipated but not fully recognized. We had the opportunity.
Sir, welcome to the committee. Please identify yourself.
Senator Marty, thank you. My name is David Wickland. I've been a resident of Minnesota since I was born in 1949. I'm a self-employed carpenter. I'm a Marine combat veteran, and I'm here to defend smokers. I'm offering an opposing viewpoint. I don't know if you people are ready for this, but I can feel the heavy hand of government coming down on my personal freedoms. As a Marine, I took an oath to honor and defend the Constitution of the United States of America, and we did our best. There's a line in there that goes, pursuit of happiness, life, liberty, the pursuit of happiness. Remember that part? Well, to me, that means I have personal freedom, and I am allowed to make my personal choices as a member of this country, as a citizen. And I don't know if smokers get any time here. This non-smoking thing is getting carried away. They tried to prohibit alcohol at one time. I remember the term prohibition. Why is it not prohibited now? I've seen the kind of destruction alcohol creates in the lives of my friends and their families. It's legal. Smoking at this time is also legal. What you're contemplating is to interfere with my pursuit of happiness and my liberty. That's a personal choice that I have and we all have. I don't interfere with your freedom or your personal choices. I do not intend to. I wish that you would not interfere with these individuals in the state of Minnesota and the personal choices that they can make as an individual and free people. The heavy hand of government comes down hard. When I was in the Marines, there was a Hoopa Indian. He said when they discovered gold on his reservation, before he was born, Indians were killed to clear the land of them, and they were paid $5 a head for each dead Indian. Today we call that genocide. I've seen the heavy hand on black people. Today we call that racism. What you're doing now is following in that line. This is a free country. We are free people. We are free to choose as we wish. If you intend to legislate my behavior, then we're going to have a small war. And I'll tell you why. It's already started. I can't go into a public building and smoke. I used to be able to. Now I have to stand outside. If I buy cigarettes in the state of Minnesota, they have fire retardant in them. I can taste this. What are we going to do? Is it equal and fair treatment under the law for everybody? Or do only certain people get fair treatment under the law? You can decide as you wish. And I believe that I'm probably the only smoker that has shown up here at the state capitol to talk to you. But I thank you for that opportunity.
Thank you for your testimony, good day. Mr. Woodquin. Senator Dahl.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Sir, if I might ask you a question. I just want to know, do you... Children, you don't smoke around children, though, when you're exercising your right?
Is this single.
Okay. Thank you.
Senator Pappas, any last comments? Any other witnesses?
Mr. Chairman, I think I've spoken enough. My witnesses were very eloquent.
Senator Berglund moves Senate File 359 be recommended pass referred to the Committee on Judiciary.
As amended.
As amended. Was it amended?
Okay.
A1, thank you. As amended. On that motion, all those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed?
No.
Motion prevails.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
That all the business before the committee is completed, this meeting is adjourned.